Welcome to the Business Marketing Club podcast for B2B marketing people who want to get on and stay ahead. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair of the Business Marketing Club Network. In this episode, I'll be looking at the perfect client-agency relationship in B2B marketing by speaking to Antonia Wade, the CMO of Capita, and also to Susie Clark, the MD of Omar Bono, who've contributed to a code of conduct for clients and agencies to live by. I'll also be speaking to Claire Lamb, the director of Scout, for the agency view of how clients need to shape up, and to Sameet Vimani, the global marketing director of Worldpay, for the client side view. After Sun, associate partner at Page Executive James Harrington will share some great B2B marketing examples and what he's learned from them. And Helen Braun, the marketing operations manager at Telefonica O2, will share a key B2B marketing lesson. The client-agency relationship in B2B marketing can be critical to the success or failure of a project, department, or business. It's a relationship that both parties have to invest in. So how to get it right? My first guests are Susie Clark, who is the MD of Omar Bono, and Antonia Wade, who's the CMO of Capita. Both have contributed to a code of conduct for clients and agencies to live by. Antonia, Susie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
Tell us about your business and your relationship to each other, and maybe starting with Antonia.
Thank you. So I'm the Chief Marketing Officer of Capita. Capita is a consulting digital services and software business. We're about £4 billion company, and we employ about 63,000 people. We have clients, large number of clients in the government sector, but we also work with financial services, utilities, retail, and we offer things from customer management and citizen management all the way through to quite niche specific, industry specific software services. So quite a broad business. I joined Capita in February last year as part of a multi-year transformation program. And I've spent the last year and a bit looking at how to improve marketing for Capita. So really thinking about from a brand perspective, what did we need to do to use brand to leverage our growth? How did we think about how marketing helped make money for this business, but also to create it into a place that's really great for marketers to build and grow their careers? And I met Omar Bono a number of years ago. So prior to Capita, I did two transformational roles at Thomson Reuters, which is a data agent company that markets into the financial services business. But before that, I did 10 years at Accenture. And whilst I was at Accenture in my UK role there, we brought Omar Bono as part of a roster of agencies into work for Accenture. And I've been working with Omar Bono pretty consistently ever since. So in three different employers across probably the last 10 years. And I started working with Susie when she joined Omar Bono. Gosh, I don't know, Susie, was it two years ago.
Susie, to your same question to you, tell us a bit about Omar Bono and your relationship to...
Omar Bono is a B2B agency. I have been working there for about 2 years. And that's obviously when I met Antonia. And I hope Antonia doesn't mind me saying that last year, Capita ran a pitch to re-roster their agencies, so a preferred supplier list. So we were invited to go through that process, and we were awarded a place on the roster, I think it was in December last year. So we've been working together since then.
Cool. Antonia, what's your experience of client agency relations in B2B marketing more generally?
So I think that I guess there are three elements for me that I've learned over the last 20 years or so that I've been working in marketing and B2B. Firstly, I mean, I think B2B marketing continues to evolve as a discipline, which is why it's a really exciting place to build and grow your career. But because it's evolving, it means that it's not always easy to predict what it is that you need. And so working with a great selection of agencies really helps you to push the boundaries on new things that you could be doing to add value for clients. It helps you to understand best practice in the market. And of course, it helps you to fill skills and capacity gaps where you need to. So you're really thinking about, you know, how can you use your relationships with agencies to really engage clients in an incredibly different way. Secondly, I spent the last sort of 6-7 years as a more of a transformational CMO. And typically when you do that, you are looking to change the skills profile and potentially the value that you as a function add to the rest of the business. And so agencies become incredibly important then, because you really rely on them as part of your extended team. And it shifts the dynamic somewhat in terms of, you know, what is the ask of each other. And I guess that speaks to my third point, which is, you know, increasingly we use and think about chemistry as one of the most important factors by which we think about who we want to work with. Because it's my firm belief that, you know, great agencies, of which we're lucky, you know, there's a lot of them, but, you know, the great agencies will all do great work for you, but it's actually the environment that you create where teams feel like they can work together, they can collaborate, they can be constructively critical, they can encourage creativity. You know, creating that environment really comes down to the right chemistry within the team. And I think that that has really been my big learning of working with great agencies, of which Omobono is one, which is if you get the chemistry right and you get a really good team of talented people on the agency and the client side, you can really create remarkable work.
So Susie, from the agency perspective, do you recognise those three points?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, chemistry probably is the number one for us. It's really important to us that, you know, we enjoy working with our clients and that we're, you know, united with a common goal. I mean, through any process of pitching or you know, co-creating or even getting, you know, winning a new client, we would almost always ask that we have some semblance of face-to-face meeting. Not always possible, because increasingly clients are international, and definitely this is not possible under the current COVID situation. But it's really important that we get to look each other in the face and understand, you know, whether culturally we're a good fit, because, you know, we all want to create wonderful work and create wonderful results, but we want to enjoy it whilst we're on that process.
And Susie, you were involved in developing the code of conduct, I think, from the beginning. So why did you feel it was useful to develop something like that?
I mean, it came from a number of conversations, I think, that, you know, we had from agencies getting together. I mean, the agency environment is competitive. Pitching is a standard part of what we do. And candidly, I'm okay with that. You know, we know that that's something that we have to do, and may the best agency win. But there were some really bad habits that were creeping in, which I guess from both sides, I'm not just saying that from a client side, but I think from an agency perspective too. So we had a discussion about how could we sort of shine a light on good behaviours, because there are some brilliant examples of really good pitch processes that have been run. So we decided, you know, through these conversations, that wouldn't it be great if there was an industry-led, an industry-supported code of conduct that everyone could ladder up to. I guess really exactly it's to make both parties accountable through that process. And I think it will help parties, you know, both parties to have open conversations and honest conversations, so that, again, you know, no one is wasting their time and everyone's on the same page, and we can start, you know, the foundations of a good relationship that will prosper and flourish as we go on.
I guess building on that then, Antonia, why do you think having a code will help agencies and clients work better together, particularly in these difficult times right now?
Yeah, so, and I mean, in my experience of working in Accenture, being in professional services, is obviously you're charging for your time. And so you start to get a different appreciation, really, of the kind of human capital costs of something like pitching and poor briefing. And I, you know, I do think that where I come in and see projects that have spiraled out of control in terms of cost, or even in terms of quality in some cases, it's often because it wasn't really very clear at the outset what was required. And I think that what that can lead to then is actually a really disappointing spiral where it suddenly gets very tactical and very expensive very quickly. And, you know, going to the point that Susie and I are both making about partnerships and relationships and chemistry, you know, that sort of then starts to really to sort of sour, or at least to reshape kind of what the relationship's about. You know, so for me, you know, being really clear at the outset about what it is your expectations are, that then enables a really level playing field by which you should be able to see the best of all of the agencies and genuinely look at them against each other and pick the right agency for the job. And, you know, there are, you know, Susie and I, you know, Susie mentioned the fact that they came onto the roster, but, you know, there've been times when Emma Bono pitched for things and not won them because they haven't been the right agency for what we've needed to be done. But if you're not clear as a client about what is it exactly that you need, what does good look like, but also what are the components that are really important to you in the process, then you run the risk of choosing the wrong agency for the wrong job. And so, you know, one of the things I appreciate about Susie, for example, will say, you know, if you want to do this type of work, we're probably not the right agency. Whereas if you want to do this type of work, then, you know, we'd love to be considered. And I think that that's very helpful as a CMO when you've got a budget, which, you know, all budgets are lean at the moment, heavily scrutinized, where you are making any kind of agency investment. You want to make sure that you're really clear about what value you're going to get back from it.
Would you agree with that, Susie, that kind of it's not in Emma Bono's interests to kind of end up as an agency for something that isn't kind of your core skill set?
Yeah, I mean, and we are very clear about that and have as much honesty as we can with clients at the moment. I mean, for example, you know, where do we see that we can add value? It's in things like strategy and the big idea. Where we won't add value is doing rollout of thousands and thousands of assets, because we will just come across as expensive. There are cheaper ways of doing that, and it's not where we're adding the value, the real value that we can. So I think, yeah, I think, you know, that's exactly right. And I think you build better trust-based relationships with clients when you can have those honest conversations. Or if we know we don't have experience of it, you know, if you came to us and asked us to do something that's not in our wheelhouse, you know, the agency would have no qualms to say, you know, that's not our area of expertise, but we can find a partner to partner with if that's what you want, or, you know, we can think outside the box. But we don't ever want to lie or pretend that we can do something that we can't, because both parties will end up being disappointed. We won't deliver the quality work that the client wants, and we'll probably, you know, bust a gut trying to do it and all be unhappy at the end of the day. So again, really, it's about that sort of honest and transparent conversations throughout the whole process.
And I'd build on that in two ways. I mean, so I think, you know, another area where, you know, I think it's really important is what can happen sometimes is, you know, you have the pitch and you get this incredible team turns up, but actually then the team that then delivers, whether that's on day one or actually as the project progresses, suddenly you feel like actually you're helping some junior people in an agency learn on the job versus really buying the skills and talent that you thought you would. And the second observation that I would make was more to offer up as a discussion, perhaps, is, you know, there are some things, so I've talked about clarity of what it is you're looking for, but then there are some things where you aren't necessarily clear, where you make assumptions, and perhaps it's something to think about: how much clearer should a client be around things like how important inclusion and diversity is, how important sustainability and supply chain rigor is. And some of those things, I think, that particularly if you work for a very purpose-driven organization like I do, you sort of assume that that goes with the territory, and perhaps sometimes it doesn't, which can lead to a slight disconnect in expectation between client and agency in the pitching process. So that's one for discussion, but I think it's an interesting area for us to think about as the code matures.
And maybe moving away from the code, Antonia, what's the most useful advice that you think you can give to clients who have existing agency relationships right now as things to focus upon?
Well, one of the things that, I mean, you know, we're in a situation like many others where we are being very heavily scrutinized on spend. It's obviously the right thing for our business that we're doing that. So really what I've been very impressed by and are humbled by, actually, is some of the agencies that we work with have been extremely proactive in terms of offering thoughts, ideas, trends, thinking about trying to put themselves into our position really cleverly and creatively, and coming up with suggestions of things we could do. Some of them have offered a bit of pro bono time, and it's just been really great, actually, to see that investing in the right agency relationships and making them relationships. I mean, one of the things that I think about relationships is, you know, the hallmark of a good one is that it's in the good times and in the bad times, right? And, you know, if you're in the worst times, you know, who's the person you want to reach out your hand and hold as you step off the cliff? And that's really, you know, if you have that attitude towards what a relationship is, then as buyers are suffering squeezes on budgets, you know, it's really marked to me to see how some of our agency partners have really stepped up into it in a really wonderful way. And I would just appreciate Omo Bono and others for doing that.
Susie, how can agencies provide value to clients at this time?
I think it's exactly as Antonia said. I mean, from my perspective, it's about understanding your client and then, you know, adding value wherever you can, but equally being mindful of the fact that everyone's being scrutinised at the moment. So what we're not doing is going in and trying to flog anything that we can to our clients, because I can imagine that would just be bloody annoying. So it's more, you know, adding value exactly as Antonia said. So saying, you know, that you might not have considered this, or here's some trends that we see, or we did a lot of work initially when COVID first happened around how you digitize, you know, the offline experience. So we were helping people to understand how they could do a sales deck in the digital environment, for example, or giving tips and tricks on things that we do a lot. So again, you know, it's just like any relationship, it's about understanding what their needs and requirements are and working with them to help support that. And having brave conversations. I mean, you know, I've had brave conversations with a number of our clients saying, where are you at? What's going on? What's the response that your company is taking? And how can we adapt to meet those needs?
So to understand those needs, I guess you need clients to be giving you certain bits of information. What would be good to know?
I mean, I think it's good to know where the business is going. I mean, again, you know, discretionary spend, which marketing largely falls underneath, is being heavily scrutinised. So I was like, you know, if the budgets are not going to be there, let's have that conversation. And we can make sure that any resource that you require is there as and when you need it. But it comes down to communication, you know, giving us enough information that we can respond, but equally being transparent enough that, you know, if the work is not going to flow, that we can respond to that as an agency and manage our own costs. I mean, that's what we're both doing really as partners, is both looking and managing our costs. So if we can do that hand in hand, it makes things a lot easier for both of us.
And back to the code of conduct, will you both be using it in the future?
Yes. I mean, to what extent? I mean, I think it's safe to try, and we will experiment with it and test. I think it's quite thorough, so thank you for that. And I think, you know, it will evolve. As Antonia said, there's areas that I think we haven't thought about. But I think, yes, I think it will enable us to say there's this industry standard code that we adhere to. And for any net new client, what do you think? I don't think that we will always be able to tick every single box. I mean, for example, it says things like one of the clauses, I think, is that, you know, at least two people who attend the pitch will be the two people that work on the business at all times. Now, if we don't know what that piece of business is going to look like, or the size or shape of it, it could be difficult for us to do that. But we can equally say, look, you know, we adhere to it, but in this instance, we're not sure about this one because we don't really understand what the universe looks like yet. But it will mean that we can have a more honest, robust conversation, you know, at the very beginning of any engagement.
I would agree with that. I think, you know, the important thing is you make a start, right? I mean, yep. It's rare that you go from zero to perfection in anything that one does. So, I mean, making a start is the right thing to do. And then I think it's about making sure that both sides of the conversation are feeding back. And then I do think, I'm hoping that at some point, you know, year, 6 months, whatever it is, you know, then to start to say, well, what were the areas that were particularly challenging, or what are the particular trends and norms, and how do we as combined collective, a creative force, come to solving that? So Susie and I were talking a little bit about, you know, using the pitch process as a means of benchmarking incumbents against the market. Well, you've got to think that there's a different and better digital anonymized way of me being able to benchmark whether my incumbent project is kind of within a range that satisfies the absolutely fair and right procurement requirement that Capita puts on me as one of the biggest spenders of the business. But doesn't incur loads and loads of cost for businesses, to Susie's point, that are trying to balance out supply and demand. And of course, there's an opportunity cost of putting people on bids. So, you know, I think that, you know, all's making a start, but then really looking at it and saying, well, where do you build from with the code? And how do you start to identify these norms? And really, you know, typically in a situation like I just described, it's mutually beneficial to everyone to come up to with a better way, because pitching also takes a lot of time and effort on the client side too. So, you know, you want to make sure that you have to, that you're, you know, really, we can think about that in a very creative and collaborative way.
Cool. So, Susie, how can I access the code?
It's currently hosted on a website. I will find actually what the URL is. It is b2bcodeofconduct.com, and you can see it there. And by all means, I think, you know, sign up to it. The more agencies and clients that we can get to hold it up as best in class will be, you know, it means that it will have the most impact. So we welcome anyone who wants to join.
Susie Clark, MD of Omar Bono, and Antonia Wade, CMO of Capita. Thank you both very much. My next guest is Claire Lamb, who's a director at Scout. Claire, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a bit about Scout.
Okay. So we're an integrated B2B marketing communications agency. We very much started life as PR and PR services, and we still have clients that just buy that area from us. But actually, as you know, as the market's developed and client needs have changed, we've kind of moved very much into what we call integrated programs. So that's just treating PR as a single channel for communications alongside things like web or digital or social. So we tend to build out these programs much more broadly now than we probably did 5 or even 6 years ago. We've just literally celebrated our 10th birthday last month, so we're very proud of that. It wasn't quite the celebration we were hoping for, as I'm sure you can all imagine, but we celebrated nonetheless. You know, lockdown kind of gets in the way of all sorts of things, but we had a really good virtual celebration with our team, and we're hoping that we'll be able to extend that out to clients in the not too far distant future, certainly before we get to our 11th birthday anyway.
That would be good. And so you came to my attention because you're forecasting the end of the client agency pitch. So tell us perhaps a bit more about that forecast, and then maybe we can talk some more.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, we really do think it's time for it to finish, and we're seeing indications that it is coming to an end. And, you know, not before time, really. I mean, I've been in the agency business for about 25 plus years, and there's been absolutely no revolution or even evolution in the way that clients and agencies start to work together, really. And it's, you know, it's high time that we see that kind of that balance between the two change. You know, and we do think it's changing, and we're seeing indications from clients, especially the ones that we're talking to at the moment, that, you know, the pitch process for them isn't necessarily working because it is just really time intensive. And as markets move really quickly now, particularly, you know, B2B at the moment and currently in this situation, so it's much better for everybody all around, actually, if we can find a way to streamline this process and make it more efficient. One of the things that we came across recently that kind of started the thought process behind this was that actually, you know, the content machine as it stands has been pretty phenomenal in the last couple of years, but actually it now means that most prospective clients are being touched by agencies almost 11 times before they actually make any inroads in kind of picking up the phone and having a conversation. And in that time, they've got a good idea about who you already are, you know, the kind of agency that you are, the kind of creative ideas that you're pushing out, because you're already targeting them from a marketing perspective. And if nothing else, that pitch process would be so welcome if it comes to an end, mainly because it's just incredibly unfair, because the balance of power remains unequal. And how can you expect to find a partnership relationship when you start off with this very unfair balance of power? You know, the only winner, as everyone likes to say, really, in the pitch process is always going to be the client.
So I guess you'd be arguing then that agencies right now contribute too much to the pitch situation.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a very natural thing to happen. You know, as an agency, when you go into a pitch situation, you want to win. So you're going to give it your best shot. And if that means investing more than perhaps, you know, even the client relationship would be worth, a lot of agencies will take that on board. Some agencies don't cost it properly in terms of the way that they pitch. They don't really allocate resourcing on a month-on-month basis. So actually, often they're pitching without the time or the resources to be able to allocate it in the first place. And that already makes them unprofitable. But actually, the balance of power, I think that's one of the real fundamental issues, is that, you know, clients hiring typically an agency because they lack the expertise, or they lack the internal knowledge or the resources. And they come to you because that's what they're looking for you to fill. But if they're coming to you looking for a partnership, but the balance of power really sits with them, that puts you already on a very uneven footing. And then the last thing, I would say really is that client expectations, I think, in the last kind of 3 or 4 years have been really, really much higher than ever before. One of the questions that we're often asked in this situation, right at the beginning, when we kind of start at the brief point, is we're just interested to know how you're going to approach it. But by very definition, that question means a million things to a million different people, different types of agencies. You know, often you need to come back to them with a creative idea, but that creative idea is something that you're giving away for free. And there is an expectation to give that creative idea away for free. But actually, to build that creative idea and make sure that it works, you have to put that within the bounds of a strategy and an approach. And that strategy, again, is now being almost a requisite at pitch stage, when it really shouldn't be. You know, to create a good, sound strategy that you can measure, that you can set targets against, and that you can report back on, and actually achieves your objectives, requires quite a big deep dive, really, into a client's business and their audiences and their markets.
So is there, though, a middle way where we can try and address some of the points that you make without completely replacing the pitch?
It's hard. I think there is a middle ground, absolutely. But it's you know, and this is, don't get me wrong, this can't be on for as long as I've been in PR, I think, really. And I think unless we can kind of change an industry, which is obviously much, much harder to do, then, you know, we will, unless everybody in the agency business supports it, we'll find it very hard to kind of change that industry. I think there is a middle ground. There's a few things that I think really agencies need to look at, and actually it's beneficial for them to do so. A minimum, I would argue, that actually if a client is going out and asking more than 3 agencies to pitch, those agencies should turn it down. You can pick up quite a lot of things from how clients approach the pitch process. If there's more than 3 of you, obviously your odds of winning are greatly reduced. But what it also shows is that client really hasn't done its homework in terms of researching the marketplace and understanding who would be their best fit. If there's no brief, for example, and you would be amazed at how often this happens. You know, many clients come to you and they have no brief written. And that means, again, to us, that they haven't really put any forethought into what it is that they really want, or again, what it is that they can achieve. Rob and I have this standing joke that, you know, we have a set of slides that are, you know, the 3 or 4 main objectives that we're given when people don't have a brief. One of them is, I think we need to make some noise. I mean, what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything to anybody. Noise to who? Who do you know is going to accept and listen to that noise? We're also often tasked with an objective of, we've got a product launch. Again, that's not an objective, it's not a good reason. And you can see all of these questions that come up without having a good, strong brief, having put some forethought into what it is that they're trying to achieve. The third thing I would always say is budget. Again, lots of clients often come and say, you know, this is what we want. And you say to them, how much budget have you got to spend? And they say, well, you tell me how much it costs. It's an impossible situation because inevitably in those situations, you're priced out. So actually, if price was important to them, that should have been one of the first things that they told you. And that kind of brings me on to my second to last point, really, which is transparency. Again, the middle ground on this is transparency. Clients that keep you at a hand's distance during the pitch process aren't going to be the clients that you really, really want to work with in the long term. They need to be able to share with you how many other agencies are pitching and who else they're talking to, because that will give you, as an agency, really an understanding of the kind of agency that perhaps they're looking for. And if you don't fit that, then it might not be worth your investment. Then my last point, and I promise this is the last point, is really actually agencies. On the agency side, we need to get much, much better at perhaps productizing our service offering. I think so many agencies dress up what they do, that sometimes for clients who, you know, maybe don't have the experience of buying in services from agencies, can get a bit lost in, they can get a bit wrapped up in the words and not really understand what that service delivery involves. Rob and I came to the conclusion a few years ago that actually one of the most important processes we put into place is an onboarding process for clients. So they know exactly what they've bought, because in 6 months' time, you know, they've bought into this, not smokes and mirrors, but if they've bought into the words, often the deliverables almost become second as part of that pitch process.
You've mentioned Rob a couple of times. You should just say what you're talking about, Rob Skinner, the MD at Scout, right?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a middle ground. What about if we went to the absolute extreme? Should we replace the pitch completely? And if so, with what?
That's the challenge, I think, because it's happened in a few circumstances. So we've seen, procurement obviously becoming involved and absolutely, you know, putting out the RFPs that change the entire process. And, you know, I know every agency puts their hand up and says, well, this is ruining any kind of creativity because we don't have the opportunity to show you how creative we can be when it's just literally a spreadsheet filling in exercise. But I do think there is room, there's room for both. And in fact, I think in a way, you know, I mentioned I've been around for quite a long time, but there's also an argument to say, let's go back, you know, let's go back 25 years where chemistry meetings actually used to almost were the foundations of every pitch process. You know, you have the opportunity to meet the client face to face, and that's a rarity. I mean, obviously not right now, that's not a possibility, but clients really did invest, or prospective clients invested more time. They understood that to get the best out of that pitch process, they had to put something in. So chemistry sessions were really, really important. You could instantly, as an agency, actually really understand how you could work with this client or not, and it was important from both sides. And I think really as a step that should come in, I'm just doing some research into this just to see if I could find some really good examples. And actually one of the best ones I came across is actually almost infamous in the way that they approached it, and it goes back quite a few years, but actually you can see the balance of power completely shifted. So it was EE, or back in the day as they were known, I think they were everything everywhere back in the day. The mobile phone company, tech company as well before that. They did exactly that. They did, they wrote their brief and it was considered. They got all their key stakeholders to feed into that, not just the PR team or the comms team. It went out to broader marketing. It was clear objectives, clear budgets. They took that brief and they went in and they did chemistry meetings with 10 agencies on the agency office premise. They didn't come to them, they went to the agency, they didn't have the agency come to them, because what they felt was that it would give them a real opportunity and some insight into who they are and how they operate. And then they went through some slight nuances. So there was I'm not quite sure we want to go to this extreme, but there was little things like they removed the most senior person from the room from the agency side and gave the rest of the team a task. And then they brought the senior member back in for the last 10 minutes to see how they interacted with each other, to see whether it was led by the senior member or whether it was a team effort. So there was lots of nuances, and that was before the agency had prepped anything. So they hadn't even got to pitch stage. And I think, whilst that might be a little overwhelming for some clients these days, I do think there is a shifting of that balance of power and input that's required.
Interesting stuff. Claire Lamb, Director at Scout, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My next guest is Sumeet Vamani, who is Global Marketing Director at WorldPay. Sumeet, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
We're focusing today on how to build great client and agency relationships. And we've been hearing from agencies about how, for them, the pitch process doesn't really work. So I'm interested in the client side view on the pitch here. What do you think to it?
I've had definitely mixed experiences over the years in terms of the pitch process. And I think probably one of my biggest frustrations with the pitch process is there is often a lack of research done. A lot of, you know, opportunity in the pitch process is an opportunity for an agency to demonstrate that they've, you know, really looked into the business that they're trying to engage with, that they really understand the marketplace, that they're able to demonstrate knowledge that beyond a study that, you know, Forrester may have delivered that any one of us could have read. You know, they have the opportunity to really show some extra value in that process. And often what I have come across over the years is I get the veneer, I get the very top level of we know your business up to a point, you know, in a stock way, and then here comes the sell. And really, that I see an opportunity gap for agencies to bridge really and to demonstrate their value in that process.
How can agencies, would you recommend, go about filling that gap?
So I genuinely think it's about building those relationships outside of a pitch process. So really starting to really being present within the industry, being, you know, vocal, active, having a perspective, you know, challenging us, you know, as marketers to think differently, but also have a listening ear. I think often what I don't often see with the kind of the agency world is a lot, whole lot of listening. Because there are a lot of very, you know, strong perspectives out there. But often, you know, we lack that kind of ear of understanding, okay, what's our real business need? Why are we looking to engage with you in the first place? So I think as much as you can be using the power of things like LinkedIn and digital means, there are a number of signals out there that we're giving in many different forums that would enable any agency to be able to hold their own and be that listening as well as having their own perspective.
So that's something where on the kind of agency scorecard we're kind of marking them as could do better. What about some examples of things that they do well?
So I think from a thought leadership perspective, I get a huge amount of value from events, content, white papers that agencies put out. So a lot of the information that I get in order to keep myself ahead of the game and abreast of what's the latest thinking in the industry comes through an agency network of people that I've met over the years, but also through, you know, to LinkedIn and Twitter and whatnot. So I think,
and sorry, does that come across in the pitch as well?
It can do. I think sometimes there's a trick to be that's missed. But I think I've had some really good experience and great examples where, you know, an agency has really come forward with great thought leadership, great unique perspectives. You know, really try to understand. And ask the right questions to understand, okay, what's the crux of why you've brought us in? And I think, you know, agencies have the talent and the, you know, the creativity to come forward with some really fantastic ideas to challenge us to do different.
Okay. And of course, relationships are two-way. So we've been talking about the agency side pitch role. What's the client side pitch role?
So the client side pitch role for me is to be very clear in your brief. And, you know, briefing with agencies from an in-house perspective is a challenge that I have had for many years in terms of, you know, an education that I've had to take teams through so that we're better clients in an agency client relationship. But clarity, honesty and transparency in terms of timelines and in terms of understanding the challenge of being able to work with an agent with a business of the size of, say, a Worldpay. And, you know, honesty in being able to hold each other to account. So if you think that we're doing something wrong, I want to hear that. I don't want you to be afraid. I want that openness of dialogue. But equally, I will give that back. And I think that is only a healthy thing. And I think if you can create a true partnership, it's the most effective way of being able to unlock the potential of any agency client relationship.
Can you give us an example of where the relationships between agency and client have really worked well?
I can. I won't give the agency in question, but I have worked with an agency in the past where they have spent a huge amount of time really looking to get to know us before even engaging in any work. So they haven't looked to, you know, charge a huge amount of money for spending the time getting to know our business to really understand, okay, what what is the opportunity here for our business, not what's the opportunity for the agency to sort of build revenue streams out of us. And seeing it as a long term, not seeing it as a kind of short term tactical project by project basis, but actually a long term relationship. So definitely at my time at Semantic, but also at my time at Worldpay, we've worked with a number of agencies, both small and large. So, you know, size is not the challenge here, but personality and willingness to kind of roll sleeves up and do stuff that sits maybe beyond the brief or beyond the contract is something that I really admire, and it's something that I value a lot in any of my relationships.
With what result would you say that the outcomes of that type of relationship are better than other types of collaboration, and if so, with what result?
Yeah, so definitely. I've worked with an agency in the past where we have brought, you know, forward a campaign idea that we would never have really thought about ourselves or even really have taken into account had it been presented without the, you know, ongoing relationship that we already had. And that sort of campaign in itself generated over $10 million dollars worth of additional revenue for our business at that time, you know, through a concept that was completely creative, was completely challenging to our business norm, but it was on the basis of the trust, the transparency, the honesty, and, you know, the long-term nature of that relationship that I, as the marketing lead, felt, okay, I want to give this a go. And I knew that it wasn't just being done because they wanted to win an award. It was being done because they truly understood our business, and the results spoke for themselves.
Sumeet Vimani, Global Marketing Director at Worldpay. Thank you very much.
There's some great B2B marketing out there, and I'm joined now by Associate Partner of Page Executive, James Harrington, to look at some of it. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
So great B2B marketing that's out there. What's caught your eye?
Well, I'm going to put a slight spin on great B2B marketing because I think there is a wealth of great B2B marketing out there that exists in terms of promoting organizations to their customer base. But I've been quite underwhelmed with how organizations really market themselves from a careers perspective.
Okay.
I want to talk about some organizations that have obviously invested quite heavily in terms of how they take themselves to market and how they promote themselves to prospective candidates.
Okay.
So I've got two organizations to kind of quickly run through with you. One of those examples is the Secret Intelligence Service. So an organization steeped in history, but one not exactly known for promoting itself. It identified that it was struggling to really get prospective candidates through the door in volume. So these guys went out with the help of the marketing agency and totally reconstructed their careers section. So what the end result was is a really engaging careers website, which talks about the history of the organization, what it does in the marketplace, and takes a prospective candidate through in an interactive manner. What it's like to work for the organization, the dynamics, the culture. It dispels myths about the organization and what it's like to work for it. So I think it's just a great bit of marketing, and it really helps, I think, connect with potential candidates in the market and give a bit more information to potential candidates.
What impresses you about this then? So, you know, is it that candidates, when they are looking for new roles, tend to struggle to get under the skin of an organization?
I think we've all been candidates at some point in our career, at certain points, Dave. And I think we all know that when we're looking for a prospective organization to join, we really want to feel as if we know who the organization is, what it's about, what it's like to work for, the types of people that are within the organization. And I think if organizations are not promoting that in the right manner or in enough detail, they're just not going to get enough candidates through the door or excited enough at the very start of the journey when you're going to go through a process with an organization. And I think today, more than ever before, where content is king, if you're not presenting the right content through the right channels to take candidates through a journey, you're just not going to do the best job in the marketplace in what is a very competitive market out there at the minute.
Okay, and what's your second example?
So it's an organization that's got revenues of 6.7 billion, but probably most people haven't heard of. It's an organization called Nexans. And these guys are a cabling business that provide industrial power and data cables. So probably not what you and I would call the most glamorous organization, but these guys have done a fantastic job in taking what they do and making it really engaging and actually a really exciting proposition. So the organization, again, have worked with an agency partner and created a fantastic careers website, which if you were a prospective candidate, you would log into their microsite and find yourself on a tour. And a gentleman picks you up in reception and then takes you all around the world from seeing the cables that lie underneath the UAE powering the cities over there, all the way up to the Arctic, and in the operating tables within the hospitals. So it's an organization that is completely under the radar to the majority of individuals that are out there, but they've really kind of, I don't know, gamified perhaps their career site and taken people on a tour of what they do in different markets and in different parts of the world. So I was just really impressed with the different take on how this information can be represented through different media.
And I guess there they've really worked hard to bring alive an organization that actually isn't terribly well known and isn't, and it, you know, it's not, when it comes down to it, you kind of really need to know what the organization does and need to be able to see it. And it sounds like the site is able to do that.
They've really brought to life what they do, who they do it with, and made it really engaging. So I was really impressed with that.
And what would you say you've learned from both of those examples that you will apply to your future work?
Well, whenever I'm partnering with organizations, it's about advising every business, every decision maker on how they can best run their recruitment campaigns. And obviously, that's going to be directly with us, but also maybe indirectly with the organization going out to market themselves. So I think businesses, however large or small, can really play an active role in how they promote their business to prospective candidates through the different channels. So whether you're a small organization based in the home counties or a large corporate in London, you have to promote your organization with the right content through the right mediums in order to drive candidate application levels.
James Harrington, Associate Partner, Page Executive. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Finally, Helen Braun shares a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to being marketing operations manager at Telefonica O2. Helen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be here.
So what skills and qualities got you to where you are today?
Well, I've been at O2 for a really long time, since before it was even called O2. So I guess one quality is sticking power in that. And working in marketing ops, that's definitely on the analytical side of marketing. So some of the things that you need are an interest in tech, and you need to be comfortable with detail and process, because that's what the day job's about. Although while it's really delivery focused, I think it's still important that you're able to look wider and see the outcomes that all that marketing is driving for the business. And I guess over a long marketing career, every marketing role I've worked in, there's always been three things that you need every day. And to me, those are being curious, being able to keep learning because everything changes so fast, and also the collaboration skills so you can work with other people.
So maybe we should pick up on each of those in turn, starting with being curious. So I'm curious, is that a skill that you can learn, or do you just either have it or you don't?
I think you can learn any new skill, can't you? And it, like in any job, you have to balance your time. I mean, I work in ops, and, you know, the Scott Brinker MarTech landscape is 8,000 odd strong now. So if I was curious to the extent of researching those all day, every day, I wouldn't do anything else. But I also think you have to be able to sit back and think, well, what does this mean? So if there's a new platform or a new marketing tech vendor, you have to be able to ask those questions and look behind it and evaluate it in terms of what it could do for your business. So, I mean, I feel I've become more questioning in that way through time. So, yeah, I would say you can learn that, but it's helpful if you have a framework around it, because there's not enough hours otherwise.
And so the framework is the thing that filters the relevant stuff versus the less pertinent.
Yeah, and maybe that's just me, but that's how I see it.
And do you also have to create a framework for fitting curiosity into your day? I mean, do you block out time to do it or something like that?
Well, I think most of it is just naturally. I mean, I think you learn most from other people. So just day-to-day working with colleagues, agency partners, external networking. I mean, you're really upskilling all the time, aren't you? But the other main thing for me, and it's really simple, it's just reading and online content. I know the internet can be a rabbit hole and, you know, you get lost forever, but I follow some really amazing people on Twitter and subscribe to some newsletters that keep me up with trends and MarTech far more than, I would ever know myself. So those guys just keep me informed. And of course, there's podcasts and webinars from the BMC.
Oh, yes. Other podcasts and webinars are available, of course.
Yeah, we have to say that as a disclaimer. But just going to those thought leaders in marketing, it's a great way of distilling a lot of content into one place. And you know a newsletter is valuable to you if you keep that email and read it. And I've got a few that are valuable. And that I just find that really useful. And the icing on the cake from time to time is doing formal training, but that's more of a extra layer, I guess.
That's a bit of a luxury, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's not something you do all the time, is it? But, you know, I've been lucky enough to go to some events and external training courses that have been really useful.
The second thing that you said was to keep learning. And is that kind of the same as being curious?
I guess it is, but it's also being reflective about it, isn't it? Because it's working out what's useful to you. I mean, everyone's got strengths and weaknesses, so you have to be your own personal development manager, I guess. And I because I'm working on marketing technology, there's a lot of it out there, and I have to understand the wider picture, but then determine like which bits of it I'm going to invest more time and more detail in, either because it's relevant to a project or because it's personal weakness, it's something I need to get up to speed on. So I think the curiosity is the start and the learning is more the end game, really.
And that's a nice way of looking at it. And is the process that you would use to keep learning the same as the process that you would use to ensure curiosity? So establish a framework for yourself that allows you to learn the right things.
Well, I have never really thought it through.
Well, now's your chance, live.
At O2, one of the things we are encouraged to have is a personal development plan. And it is the kind of thing comes up in conversation with your manager. And, you know, and I'm a marketing ops person, so, you know, I'm a bit of a person for structure and having a list. So I do have some personal development stuff or learning stuff as action items, because if I don't turn it into an action and put it on a list, there's a fair chance it's never going to happen. So, yeah, I suppose you can turn it into a bit of a project. And it's essential that you do. I mean, I've worked in marketing for a long time, and it just changes so fast. all the time. So you have to keep alert, as the current saying goes.
And then finally, there was collaboration. So tell us a bit about how I might go about ensuring that I'm collaborating in the right way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've spent my career working in large corporates, and you certainly don't get anything done by yourself. You're never a lone hero. So if you can't work collaboratively with others, it's hard to make much headway. But, you know, it starts with fairly standard human values, I think. And I mean, one of the things I've learned over time is you can't kind of fake collaboration. It always starts with being yourself. You don't have to be an extrovert to be a great collaborator. You know, you can be an introvert and a great listener. In fact, that's an absolutely key collaboration skill that is often underused. And I guess just my experience, the more diversity of input you have on projects, usually the better the result. So by being able to, it's slightly selfish to take on collaboration, but by being able to involve other people and get their point of view and get their contribution, normally everything works better in the end. And, you know, I work in a delivery role where I'm collaborating with marketing teams and with our agencies that are so important to us for us to be able to get campaigns out the door. So it is, you know, there's a web of relationships that makes everything work. So, you know, being respectful of people's time and listening and, you know, getting back to people, all of those are just part of the daily habit of how you work with other teams, I guess.
Helen Braum, Marketing Operations Manager at Telefonica O2. Thank you very much. And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, to Antonia Wade, Susie Clark, Claire Lamb, Sameed Vermani, James Harrington, and Helen Braum. Please do let us know what you've thought of today's podcast. Give us a rating or a review, or drop us a line at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. And if you've got something interesting, practical, and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? But no pitches, presentations, or promos, please. We're interested only in your thinking and your practical examples. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not look out in your area for Business Marketing Club mentoring, thought leadership, and events for the B2B marketing community? In fact, what's stopping you from doing that right now? I hope to see you again. I'm Dave Stevens. Thanks for listening.